Love this podcast? Support this show through the supporter feature from Acast. It's up to you how much you give and there's no regular commitment. Just hit the link in the show description to support now.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Attention, collectors of vinyl. Have you ever gone into a record store and felt overwhelmed by all the unfamiliar options? Are you frustrated by the constantly increasing prices of classic rock staples? Do you avoid streaming music or long for the days when music was recommended to you by a friend instead of an algorithm? If the answer to any of these questions is yes, then check out I'd Buy That for a Dollar, a podcast about inexpensive, common, and underappreciated records that are waiting to be rediscovered. Each week, hosts Sean, Jeremy, and Peter discuss an album and the artist's history. Previous episodes include selections by The Isley Brothers, The Carpenters, The Doobie Brothers, and Donna Summer, among others. Become a bargain bin pro and impress all your friends with cool music trivia. Listen to I'd Buy That for a Dollar wherever you get your podcasts. Please consider supporting Black Women United YEG for the protection and advancement of Black women and girls in Alberta. You can learn more about them at bwunited.ca. They are always looking for donations and volunteers. So please, again, support Black Women United YEG for the protection and advancement of Black women and girls in Alberta. Again, that website is bwunited.ca.
Hello, fellow Creative Control listeners. My name is Mac Cameron. I live in Toronto, and I have been listening to Creative Control with Vish Khanna since episode 119 that featured all five members of one of my favorite bands, Constantines. I listen backwards from there and then forwards, and I know it sounds, you know, over the top or cliche, but finding the show changed the course of my life. It inspired me to pursue a career in radio and to do what I can to support the arts in my community and across the country. So I give to Creative Control because I feel like I owe the show and Vish for helping me figure out what the hell to do with my life. Beyond that, I give to Creative Control because I think independent media, especially insightful, entertaining, thoughtful, and thorough independent media, is something that is worth paying for. What I appreciate about Creative Control is Vish's ability to treat Canadian artists, or any artist for that matter, with the seriousness and appreciation he would any other artist. His excellent rapport with people like Steve Albini and the members of Fugazi and Stephen Malkmus and others have earned him international appreciation. However, it's his trove of interviews with what I consider to be the most exciting generation of Canadian musicians, conducted out of genuine passion and interest, that makes this show so special. I think it is an archive of some really exciting music that is way, way underreported on and appreciated. That's why I contribute to Creative Control with Vish Khanna, and I hope you will do the same.
To make your flexible monthly donation to Creative Control, please visit patreon.com/creativecontrol today. I'm Vish's wife, and I will love him no matter what you do, and now he has me on the record saying that.
You made a promise. You made a promise.
Chris Rowley is a songwriter and singer based in London, England. Once a member of the short-lived but explosive and influential Huggy Bear, Rowley retreated from public performance and music making when Huggy Bear broke up in 1997. Special circumstances and the current state of the world have brought him back to us. He has teamed up with friends, including members of the band Male Bonding, to form an excellent new band called Adult Life, whose debut album, Book of Curses, is available worldwide on November 6th, 2020, via the label What's Your Rupture. Chris and I connected recently for a good chat about life in the UK these days and how he first discovered punk, the inspiring work of bands like The Nation of Ulysses, and writers like Kathy Acker, why Huggy Bear ended and Adult Life began, the rise of fascism and xenophobia, but also political engagement and positive mental attitudes, future plans for Adult Life, and more. A part of the Entertainment One Network with the support of listeners like you who follow and subscribe to this podcast and spread the word about it, and make flexible monthly donations at patreon.com/creativecontrol and Massey Hall's concert film series live at masseyhall.com, where you can stream dozens of 30-minute films for free, including performances by past podcast guests and people who haven't been on the show before, like, I don't know, Peaches. Plus in-kind support from Pizza Trocadero, The Bookshelf, and Planet Bean Coffee in Guelph, and Granddad's Donuts in Hamilton. This is the 578th episode of Creative Control, featuring the outspoken and poetic Chris Rowley of Adult Life, with your host, me, Vish Khanna. Hi, Chris. How's it going?
Hi, Vish. Good. Good to talk.
Yes, it's good to talk to you as well. First of all, where in the world are you?
Me and John are in London, in Walthamstow, East London.
Okay. How are things going in East London for you and John today?
I don't know about John. Not so good for me. I managed to get made redundant today in all this COVID scare stuff that's happening at the moment. So my job kind of disappeared and has reappeared as something else. So not the most ideal start to a day, but it's what it is.
Oh, I'm very, very sorry to hear that. That's very, very sad. And yet you made time to speak with me. That says something about you and your character. Thank you.
Thank you.
You were working for a children's charity, is that correct?
Yeah, the Lloyd Park Children's Charity. I've been there for like 20-something years.
But you're not gone. You've been reassigned, is that what you're saying?
That's kind of the way that it's looking to be at the minute. Most of my work was to do with families and services that were sourced outside of the nursery. And obviously we can't have any of those come in at the moment in the present time because of social distancing, etc. So I'm working with children and staff just inside the nursery. So no outside services, no job.
Okay, well, I'm very sorry to hear that. I hope it works out for you in this new position, I suppose, this new assignment. What actually got you into this line of work? Those of us who know you from your work in Huggy Bear know you as a incendiary punk rocker. We don't think of children in nurseries necessarily, although the name Huggy Bear, it's kind of cute. It's nice. I could see children liking that. How did you get into working with children in this capacity?
I never wanted to have a straight life job. I'd already worked in the city and had to wear a suit, and I'd been a bike courier and I'd been a hairdresser, and I wanted to do something that just felt like I was alive and at work at the same time. And I thought, why not kids? Try kids, see how that works out. I didn't have kids at that point, and I didn't even know if I particularly liked them that much, but I figured being able to do well, no, I'm just being honest, I wasn't sure. I was 20 when I started working with kids, and I just figured that if I could do art with them and sports and teach them like skateboarding and BMX bike riding, it would be like being myself, but that would be my job, like kind of teaching it onto kids. So it seemed like a good thing to start to try.
Now, I currently own two children. They are 9 and 5 9 and 5 years old. You have three children, is that right?
No, I just have one.
Oh, you have one. Sorry, I thought you had three.
Yeah, no, sometimes it feels like three, but she's just one teenager.
So I have found in my experience that the children teach me a lot about myself, weirdly. Like, I learn things about myself that I was not expecting. Has that been the case for you? Have you learned things about yourself?
Absolutely. I mean, like I said, when I first started working with kids, it was just to try another strand of what could I do with my life, what would make sense, what wouldn't suck. And then working with kids, you forget yourself, so you learn to be less selfish, and then you learn to be more responsible and more giving, and you listen more. You know, children are everyone's most precious things. I was going to say commodities, you know, but we deal with families that are handing over like their most precious person to you to look after and to nurture, you know, while they're doing their jobs or while they're working. And I'd never had that kind of responsibility given to me before, so I took it seriously. And now I'm a parent, I realize, you know, when you hand over your child into daycare or into nursery, into school, you know, it's a big deal. So I had to kind of grow into that job to prove that, you know, I was a good person to do it. And men don't do it as well, I should add. You know, like, men in childcare, I don't know about in America, but in the UK, men in childcare is kind of a weird, I was going to say niche, but not even niche. It's just a strange job to have.
Yeah.
People kind of look upon it quite suspiciously.
Yeah, here in Canada, we have a mix of men and women doing it, but you're probably right. It's predominantly women for some reason. It's just a stigma or something, or selfishness. Men are just... Men can be selfish. Men don't give as much.
I think it's like 3%, I think. Sorry to interrupt.
No, it's fine.
I think it's like 3% of the total nursery and childcare population is male, 3%. It's very small.
Well, one of the things I grew up something of a punk, and I grew up, sort of immersed in counterculture, and I find my children, at least... They're kind of like they seem sort of to exemplify those attitudes. They're open to things on some level, but they're also very much they draw the line. You know, they will resist authority, and I'm the authority, which is a real mind fuck for me. Like, I was like always like push against authority, but now I'm like, don't do that. Why are you doing that? So
it happens.
Do you see a relationship between your child and the children you're raising and sort of what got you into punk, if that makes any sense? Like, that, do you see a connection between the two?
I'm trying to think. I can remember when I got into punk, I can remember sitting at the kitchen table with my dad and telling him that I bought the Slits Cut album, which was the first punk album that I ever bought. And he was telling me, in a year's time, you're going to regret this. You're going to think it's the most ridiculous music. It's all a fad and it's all a fashion. And I didn't believe him even then, and I still love that record even now. And I see sometimes when I play music to my daughter, she's, Dad, this is ridiculous. You know, why would you like this? It sounds so old-fashioned. So, you know, it cycles. Everyone's going to reject the thing that came before or think that the new thing is a fad. And you should be rejected by your kids anyway. having those arguments and those discussions as much as they might be hurtful at the beginning, they're kind of fun.
I'm a little bit like that with video games and my son. There's a huge explosion in video game culture, and there's all sorts of different kinds. It's not just like when I was younger, you had your gaming console, and you might play like a sports game, or, you know, it was Donkey Kong and all these fantastic, but like now it's just this whole other thing. And I don't know if you're familiar with like Minecraft and all these things, but my son is into that. And I'm kind of like that with him because I don't relate to it as much because I was never super into video games. Was your father into music when he was telling you? Like, did he come from a place of authority about music when he said, the Slits? No. You need to check out Ornette Coleman or something. Was he kind of like that?
No. Oh, God, that would have been cool if my dad was into Ornette Coleman. But my dad used to have he had an 8-track in his car. And he was really into the Carpenters and ABBA and Burt Bacharach, Dionne Warwick, and it was all stuff that I pretended I didn't like, but I could see the songs were like super catchy and they were kind of cool. So we'd kind of argue about music, and I'd be like, "Oh, your taste is so old fashioned," but secretly I liked it. And then, of course, when you're in your late 20s or something, and you're over that thing of trying to be impressive and cool have like the best taste. You realize like Dionne Warwick and Burt Bacharach is like the top of the summit. It's, even when I was into like kind of the most noisy punk rock, Dionne Warwick and the Carpenters are like super good. Even if it is a hip thing to say you like that stuff, I mean, it's genuinely great.
Yeah, no, it is good. And you as we get older, we kind of appreciate not only our parents' music, but our parents' generation of interest, don't we? I don't know. I feel like it's as they're getting older and we're getting older, you ideally develop more of a sentimental connection with them. And you try to relate to them more because you're kind of turning into them. Does that make any sense? You're kind of aging into that mindset a little.
I don't know. I mean, I haven't seen my mom and my dad broke up like 35 years ago.
Oh, okay.
So I've only seen my dad in that time like three or four times.
Oh, I see.
And I don't think we're overly similar in a lot of ways, but I'm definitely sentimental about kind of looking back and thinking about my relationship with my dad. I see my mom more, so.
Right, okay. Now, for those who are listening and know of you, they would know that you were in a band called Huggy Bear, as I mentioned earlier. And what year did that band sort of cease functioning? It was a pretty short blast, right?
Yeah, so you know more than me. I think it was from like 93 to 97.
Yeah, right.
And something like that.
Yeah. So you were around for a few years and then the band stopped. Why did the band stop when it stopped, if you can reflect upon it, first of all?
Okay, so I don't know how many people even know this story. We were only ever going to be a band for 3 years. From day one, we knew that we were only going to be a band for 3 years. Whatever happened, whether no one liked us, whether everybody liked us, whether anyone dropped out, came in, we would be together for 3 years. That way we would fulfill all the things that we thought bands should do. We wouldn't waste any time. We would take every opportunity that was given. And so even to the actual day that we said that, that was when we played our last show, give or take a day.
3 years. How did you arrive at that figure?
Because that's 3 years is kind of the best time for bands to do all the things that they should do properly and not suck.
What is the precedent for a 3-year band existence? Like what were you looking at there? Who exemplifies the 3-year arc of brilliance and then fade away? Who is there somebody?
Well, the slits were really only together at the beginning for 3 years before they kind of dissipated, and they kind of, you know, they came back a few times, but they were perfect in that 3-year encapsulation to my way of thinking. And the pop group, same kind of thing. Now you're putting me on the spot. I can't think of it. I'm sure Nation of Ulysses was only like 3 years as well.
Yeah, and that was Nation of Ulysses was, and still are, seemingly based on at least one of the songs on this brilliant Adult Life record. Nation of Ulysses looms large for you and was hugely impactful. You Huggy Bear kind of formed after seeing Nation of Ulysses, is that right?
I think we had the germ or the idea of a band. We were kind of the kids that went to shows and would see whatever kind of like punk rock and hardcore bands and like kind of weird American and European bands were playing. And I don't think we were ready for Nation of Ulysses, in as much as we kind of thought it would be a fun night out, and we were just like jaws on the floor dancing, just like this is just the best. This is just the best of the best. So if we're going to do a band, this is our line in the sand. It has to be at least as good as this. And, you know, whether we ever were or not to anyone, you know, that was our kind of scorch mark.
Right. Well, I mean, unfortunately, I've seen Ian Svenonius perform in various capacities, but I never got to see the Nation of Ulysses, a bit ahead of my time, I suppose, here in Canada. They must have played up here at some point. What had you seen before that? That came close, because the one thing that'll happen is if you see a band that blows your mind, it is at least relationally compared, you know, it's sort of compared to other things you've seen. Like, no, that, the Nation of Ulysses, that is the benchmark. We saw other stuff. Had you seen anything close? Anything in that punk or hardcore milieu where you're like, yeah, that's good, but oh my God, this. Was there...
Vish, I'm really old. My memory isn't. you know the bands that I loved around that, like when I was younger than that, like I really love the Gang of Four, mm-hmm. and I really love the pop group. I really love the Slits. You know, the band that I loved the most when I was in my kind of early 20s, mid 20s, I really loved DAF, that German band.
Yeah.
They was one of the most exciting things. Maybe in a kind of a weird homoerotic Nation of Ulysses, everyone looks cool. DAF were the band, to my way of thinking, that looked the coolest before that, for completely maybe different reasons. But I can remember watching them when I was like, I don't know, 20, was I 19, 20, maybe younger, and just thinking, no other band looks like this and sounds this kind of lopsided and awesome and like not rock. Whereas Nation of Ulysses was rock music in as much as it was guitars and drums, but they kind of exploded the concepts of what that was because, you know, they played loud and it wasn't based on regular song structures. But DAF was just electronic, and I'd never heard electronic music that was like sexy and aggressive before.
Hmm.
Sorry, okay. That was a memory lane moment for me there.
No, I appreciate that these are, this is going to be something of a memory jog, and I don't want to put you on the spot too much. Please accept my apologies and forgiveness if you feel like you're not quite capturing what it was like for you 25, 30 years ago. Don't feel bad about that. No, it's fine. So if
the dates are wrong and anyone's checking, I apologize.
Yeah, this whole episode will be broken down on Wikipedia as soon as we're done, I'm sure. I'm sure that will happen. Someone will correct us. In terms of your first of all, what was your role in Huggy Bear? What did you do in that band exactly?
Well, to begin with, I wrote the songs, the lyrics. I wrote the lyrics with Nicky. John and Joe came up with the guitar and bass parts. We later got Karen Hill, God bless her, to practice drums in John and Joe's front room on old telephone directories and sticks because we didn't have a drum kit. So I would sing with Nicky. We would trade off lines together. So singer stroke songwriter sounds a bit ridiculous, but that's kind of what I was.
Well, your approach to singing and your approach to the songwriting is very unique. Do you have a sense of where it came from, this sort of abstract, blunt, you know, almost jarring way of conveying, you know, stark language that is very impactful? It's very unique. Do you have a sense of where that comes from within you?
I mean, if I'm being honest, I've got to pay homage to like writers that I've liked and people
totally.
That have
yeah,
and people that have sent me good letters that have stuck in my head, fanzines that I've read, but I never really thought about it too much. I've always liked to write, and people seem to like the things that I write and will kind of give me props for stuff that comes out good. And when you sing it, it's a bit of an abstract way to describe it, but if I have an idea for a song, I always see it as like a kind of a woodcut or a vinyl carving. I see an image of something, a person or a thing or something happening, and then I extrapolate what I think happens around that, and I'll give it some kind of socio-political kind of context. And I like things that are half dumb and half smart, so I like to explain it in a kind of political sense but then have kind of stupid stuff so I can enjoy it when I'm singing.
Yeah, I mean, that it sounded abstract, but no, that was a clear answer. I appreciate that. I mean, you obviously, you talked about Huggy Bear having this purposeful intent. Like, you knew it was only going to be around for 3 years. You weren't going to waste any time. And you have made choices, I think, as a songwriter that kind of reflect that as well. Like, you could sing about anything, but you have a tendency to say something substantive. And I think that's fascinating itself. I just wonder if, you know, that sort of sense of this has to mean something, if that was instilled with you by the Nation of Ulysses, by the Riot Grrrl movement, by other political movements. Like, your penchant for the political fascinates me, but you've also done something where you're political and poetic. It never comes across as sort of dogmatic, if that makes sense. It's always very kind of compelling and vivid storytelling. That balance between political and art, I mean, is it complicated for you, or do you? I get the impression you don't think about it too much, as you say. It just sort of comes out of you. But is that a complicated thing to balance? To be, I got to say something here, but I also want it to be kind of cool.
I don't ever care about it sounding cool, I don't think. I like things that are grounded in a reality that I understand, so that kids that I know or my friends talk like that or have had things happen like that. And maybe when we're talking to each other or we're explaining things, or if I'm sitting thinking about stuff afterwards, I can give it that kind of concentric rings of like a political dimension or a critique of what it is. You know, so a kid getting stopped by, you know, the police is an incident, but then you can extrapolate and have like the language that you think that kid or the cop would use.
Yeah.
And you could have what that means in a larger picture. So that's kind of how I build stuff up if I'm being thoughtful. But sometimes it's not even thoughtful like that. It's just random stuff that kind of, when I string it together, I realize what it is afterwards. But every day's political.
Do you have a methodology to that? Do you engage in free writing or anything like that? Or is it just like, oh, we got to write a song here, so I'm going to sit down and do it? Or do you have writing exercises?
I never ever think that. I never ever think I've got to write a song. Occasionally, if I'm emailing John, I'll have a line in the email where he says, oh, you have to use that line in a song. And I always do it because I feel that's my duty to my bandmate to put that line that he liked in the email into a song.
Yeah, okay.
I don't know. What was the question?
Well, no, just the question is, do you engage in any... You mentioned that, like, when I asked about sort of songwriting, you mentioned you wanted to tip your hat at letters you've received or fanzines, writing, you know, prose writing. Mm. Not necessarily... You didn't mention, like, Leonard Cohen or you know, songwriters. You mentioned writing. So it sounds like you have a love of language. So my question was basically, like, if you're a guy who loves language and absorbs... It processes language everywhere, and then that somehow informs your music and your songwriting. I just wonder if you say, John sees a line in one of your emails, and it might not have occurred to you to turn it into a song, but he says, "Hey, that's something. You got something, Chris." And then you're like, "Okay, I'm going to write a song." So I guess
that's just my ego being flattered. So like, if I know somebody likes even one line, I'll try and thread that into something.
Okay.
But there are writers that I like, and I, you know, if you're asking me who I like, they're not influences, but there's people that I like who I can name. They're not hidden totems or anything.
Sure, do it. I'm just curious. I just as a fan of yours and your approach to songwriting, I'm just curious if you can talk about people that you like. Sure.
Well, I always like Royal Trucks. Royal Trucks is songwriting. Mm-hmm. Whether I understood it or not, I like the weight of the words, and I like the way they look. I have a bit of a synesthesia thing in my head that certain words taste like something.
Oh.
And certain phrases inside me kind of have like a kind of a smell or a something, so I can't get rid of it. But Royal Trucks, obviously like The Fall, Marquis Smith, I always liked that writer, Dennis Cooper, but I don't think I take anything from him. I just kind of thought it was brave writing. Kathy Acker, hugely. Like people like Olivia Lang now. I can't think of what other people I like.
Well, I don't mean to put you on the spot. No, I'm just curious. I like...
If I think of some more, I'll tell
yeah,
you.
Yeah, just yell them at me as I'm midstream here, for sure. So
I sound like an LCD sound system.
Just random shout-outs. Yeah, absolutely. So, 97. Huggy Bear wraps up in 97. The narrative around you, Chris, is that band stops and you seem to disappear from sort of public life. Is that accurate? Were you making music?
Yes. No, that's completely accurate. Like I didn't want to be in a band anymore. I'd had enough of it. I'd met somebody in America that I kind of wanted to be with, and I didn't want to think about music, because being in a band kind of sucks for letting you enjoy music to a certain extent. Because whether you want to or not, you become like a bit competitive and jealous and beat down by the day-to-dayness of it. And I just wanted to get back to like liking records and making mixtapes and going out dancing and not people wanting to talk about what your band were doing or not doing. I just wanted to kind of like just enjoy life again. And the end of Huggy Bear wasn't enjoying life particularly.
Oh, I see. Even though you knew it was preordained you would be done in 3 years. There was,
yeah, I was looking forward. I was looking forward to the end of it, I'll be honest.
What was going on contextually in 1997, if we can go back to that time? I think of that time as a weird time. There was a kind of underground music explosion. A lot of it had been commodified. And on some level, that was horrible. On other levels, bands that had been kind of, you know, grinding it out for years finally got some recognition. But at the same time, it felt a little hollow. It was just a weird time. Was it the music industry that got you down, or was it the actual act of, you know, being in a band, being a performer, because I know you also tended to, my understanding anyway, is that you tended to shy away from any kind of elevation of your personality. You were in a band. You didn't do a lot of press, right? Like, you didn't try to make it about...
We only would give interviews to fanzines.
Yeah.
And occasional radio shows and things like that.
Right. So that speaks, I think, to really, you know, hardline decision making, and also is a reflection of maybe what was going on that you found kind of gross about music industry stuff. Is that fair?
Yeah. I mean, I didn't even think about it that much, but I think, I'd name check like Toby from Bikini Kill and Slim Moon at Kill Rock Stars. They were good people to kind of not school you, and you know, I would read and I'd listen to what they said, and it made complete sense. But Huggy Bear, I didn't ever. It's weird. I never even thought of us as being in the music industry. Anyway, I always thought we were kind of like a bit of an art project that got out of control. Obviously, you become carried along in the slipstream of what the music industry is, but I wasn't a big fan of the music industry at all, so I didn't consider myself to be part of it, so I didn't consider myself to be not in it when we stopped, if that makes sense.
It does. As a writer, though, as a creative person, to stop cold turkey in 1997, how did that work? The way I framed your vanishing act, if you will, was that, you know, publicly we didn't hear from you. Privately, personally, were you writing? Were you engaging with music on some level as an artist yourself?
No.
Turned it off. Turned it off like a faucet.
I didn't feel like I had anything else to write about at that time at all. Like zero. Like, I thought all the things that I would have wanted to write about during Huggy Bear, I'd written about. Anything else would have just been rehashes of stuff that we'd lived or done, because all we were doing was recording and touring and thinking about what we had to do next all the time. And after a while, you're just writing about that insular bubble that you're in. We weren't living particularly well. And
I see.
I could expand on that a little bit and say that Huggy Bear as people we were like Amish people or something. We didn't really kind of talk to people outside of this weird social circuit of people we knew or liked. We didn't mix very well, and everything was to do with what we could do for the band. So we kind of, you know, that phrase, burning the candle at both ends. I think because we only had 3 years, we burnt the candle in the middle as well.
Okay, you lived kind of hard, is basically what you're saying.
It was hard.
Did you tour rather relentlessly? Like, would you have played Canada at that time?
We did play Canada. We had to kind of... Oh, maybe I shouldn't say. Well, we played Canada and we hid under some blankets.
What?
We hid under some blankets to come into Canada a long time ago.
Whose blankets were they?
The blankets in a car that somebody was driving us.
Oh, my God. Why did you have to do that? You didn't have your papers? You didn't have your stuff?
I'm not sure if we did. long time ago, don't blame
us. Oh, wow. Well, that was a different time.
I think we played like two or three shows there.
Okay. So would you say you toured hard as a band?
Well, when we toured America, we did, because we played nonstop for like 6 weeks. The first tour, like 6.5 weeks, and we played shows nearly every day. So we'd only ever get like a day off every 4 or 5 days. That's quite a lot of shows, right?
So you've said that, you know, by the end of Huggy Bear, you felt like you had nothing to say. Did you miss perform, or rather, do you like performing? Do you like the act of being a lead singer and singing and performing for an audience?
I do now.
Now that we can't do it, now that no one can actually do it, you're
if you had asked me for like 25 years, I would have said that, you know, I never really wanted to be in a band again. I started to like music a lot more, and there were certain bands that kind of made me think, oh, that looks like fun. But it was only when me and John started to talk about doing this that I kind of thought, yeah, that would be kind of fun to do again. And I actually wanted to do it rather than just daydreamed it or half imagined it.
Yeah.
Okay. I mean, in Huggy Bear, like I liked it some of the time, but a lot of those shows and a lot of, they weren't about playing shows. They were about meeting people in the audience and having people get up on stage and read out their fanzine or their poem or talk about injustices that they'd been facing, or, you know, they were social community things, or they were us fighting a load of like beard up boys who wanted to kind of throw cans at us and fight. So a lot of the time it wasn't about, God, I really want to sing this song. It was like, how do we get out of this and kind of like in one piece? And, you know, these kids that have kind of camped out overnight to watch us, how do they get their voice heard? So it was kind of, I'm not going to say a war zone, we weren't at war, but it was difficult.
Before we get into adult life, I just want to ask you about, this is a weird term to use because you seem very modest, but I've noticed that bands of Huggy Bear's vintage have had kind of renaissance, so to speak, like that people begin to rediscover things. And so then that leads to kind of, in some cases, it's led to band reunions, it's led to reissues. Your album Weaponry Listens to Love, the Huggy Bear record, is in some circles considered a real classic. Are you aware of any inkling of interest in, like, have in the time that you were gone before adult life, did you ever hear rumblings like, you know, Chris, like, people keep downloading or ordering this record. What's going on? Like, did you
hear? No, I wouldn't know anything like that at all.
No, okay. No sense that the band's influence or importance was kind of being rediscovered.
Honestly, no.
That's fascinating.
Well, I can tell you one good story. I think it's good. So just as adult life were beginning to write songs and rehearse, this guy got in touch with me from California and reached out, and he's like a museum curator, and he does stuff like a little bit like you, Vish, to an extent, I guess.
Yeah.
He does like voice archiving and stuff. So he just reached out. I never get letters at work, for one thing. And I got this package, and he explained that Weaponry Listens to Love was like his all-time favorite record, and he had all these personal reasons for why it was important, which I won't go into. But that was the first time I'd even kind of like thought that, you know, that it had a life outside of itself, and that's what bands' music does. But that was a cool thing to hear. So then we met up, and now we're like, you know, we're really, really good friends.
Oh, nice.
Even though he lives in California, and chances of me ever getting to see him is till 2030 is probably rare.
So you disengaged from music making. What of the other members of Huggy Bear? What did they do? Do they still, you know, make music? Those sorts of things.
Joe does. Joe makes the electronic music with a partner. They have a kind of a record label within their household, and they do like kind of electronic music. I went to see her play. I hadn't seen her for 20 years, and I went to see her play a little kind of a analog synthesizer thing at Cafe Otto in London a year and a half ago, 2 years ago.
Okay.
And that was really good. That was a nice way to see her again after a long time. And what she was doing, you know, for her was perfect. It was beautiful.
Okay. Anybody else?
So John Slade, who was in Huggy Bear at the beginning for the first year and a half, was in tons of bands. He was in I'm Being Good, who were a Brighton kind of noise punk guitar kind of thing. And then he's been in Comet Gain on and off for a few years, but I don't think he is anymore. And he has a band called Snoozers, who we played with earlier this year in London.
Okay.
Who are really good. Nikki, I don't know. I haven't seen Nikki for a long time. She has a little boy, a teenager now. And Karen has two or three children and doesn't do music.
Okay. So Huggy Bear is firmly in the rear view for everyone. It's not something you have, it's not an active discussion topic or anything like that in terms of what are we going to do with our music from the past? Are we going to put it out? Is that kind of, like everything's kind of, everything you made and did, we've kind of consumed, or is there stuff that didn't come out from that era that might someday?
No, there's nothing that, there's not, everything that we did came out.
You're very, very efficient, very efficient band, it seems like.
Well, we wasn't, because we don't have any, I don't know who owns our music. I don't know who looks after it. Right. It's definitely not me.
Okay.
And I know when I talked to Jo, she was saying that it would be, you know, people do ask us all the time, don't you want to put everything out and have it available? And part of me thinks it would be nice to have it not lost, and part of me doesn't care.
Well, you have to have both to function.
I'm the worst businessman ever.
No, I think you need that. You need separation and engagement at the same time in the same breath. You have to balance that. Otherwise, it's you're thinking about the past too much, I would think. And that's not...
Yeah, you know what it is? Like you said, sometimes when people come up to you at a show and they talk about how important it was, or, you know, don't you want to have your music out so people can find it now? I can see why it would be good, but I also kind of think the whole business prospect of that just sounds horrendous.
Yeah, okay, that's fair enough. So when did Adult Life, this new band of yours, when did it kind of start exactly?
When did Adult Life start? I'm trying to think. A year and a half ago? About a year and a half. Yeah, maybe not even as long ago as a year and a half.
You're conferring with your bandmate John, who is in the room.
Sorry. Yeah, he's in the room. He's being technical and looking at his watch.
Oh, I'm sorry.
No, I'm joking. I'm joking.
Sorry to keep John too late here, but we'll try to be expedient and efficient and all this. We'll just try to be like Huggy Bear. This interview is only going to last 3 years. Just tell him that. We'll be done in 3 years. There's a cap.
I'm not going to tell him. I'll just smile.
Okay. So sorry. Did you say a year and a half ago? Is that what you said?
So I think not even that long. So we talked about it, and then very quickly we decided that we were going to rehearse. John asked Sonny, who worked in the Rough Trade, if he would like to drum, because we knew he loved drumming and he is young and we could kind of like boss him around. So for the first part of Adult Life rehearsals, we rehearsed in this really sketchy warehouse place with paper walls that smelt, and we were just a free piece. And then after we played our first live show as a free piece, we kind of talked about having a bass in it too, to kind of enrich the sound. And we knew somebody that we would like to ask, so it all slotted together quite nicely.
Okay, so since 1997, you haven't felt compelled to be in a band. You get along with some friends. I believe in England you'd call them blokes. I'm sorry, did I use that term wrong?
No, it is a term. I don't use that term or
chums.
Describe anybody I know as blokes.
What's a folksy way of saying friends in English slang? I think it's, what is it? It's blokes. No, that's not right.
Mates,
of course. Yeah, why didn't I think of that? I'm sorry. So fellas, you come into some people and you realize you have some affinity for each other on a social level. But what is going on to spur your mind, your songwriting mind, out of retirement exactly, Chris? Is it the context of the time? Is it Brexit? Is it, you know, the rise of fascism? What is going on? Am I reading too much into it?
No, because it is, Vish, that's kind of a true thing that you just said. I hadn't thought of writing for a long time. And then I knew I wanted to be in a band with John for fun, just because I love the way that he plays and I'd seen him in his other bands and I thought it would be fun. And because I love him so much as a person, I thought just doing that would be good.
Yeah.
However, working in, for the charity that I work for and living in the area of London that I live in, all of that stuff, Brexit and the rise of anti kind of, anti every, you know, like there's so much kind of like, you know, anti-immigration, anti-migrants, Brexit would be a great thing for everybody, supposedly.
Yeah.
And we live in an area that my charity is about outreach, and it's about welcoming all these people that all of a sudden were getting like horrible press. And I even saw people who, on a conversational level, that I would think I liked, who would suddenly let slip, you know, but yeah, these people are okay, but not these, you know, just like insidious small comments. We were like, well, that's the beginnings of where everything goes wrong again. If you're deciding that this set of migrants are okay because their skin is lighter or they're not from so far away, that's okay, apparently. And then, but these other ones from further away who've come from a war zone, no, that's not so good, because how can they get jobs? They don't speak the language. So, yeah, no, there was lots of things. And, you know, you just pick up stuff. And all of a sudden I was getting those images in my head again of stuff that was kind of, you know, I don't want to swear on your
You can
podcast,
swear. You can,
that,
you can curse.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Well, yeah, things that were bad. And needed, I don't know. I just felt to write again. And if I was going to be in a band, it wasn't just going to be singing about, you know, anything if it wasn't something. So all those things in my head that were issues or stuff that I thought about a lot and would give me headaches became adult life songs. Well, a lot of them were anyway.
Well,
not all of them.
Not all of them. Well, I have some perspective on the rise of the stuff we're talking about, the xenophobia, just basically anti-progress, anti-change, socio-cultural, you know, fear and hate. Like, I get where that's coming from a little bit here. Do you have a perspective on why this is occurring where you live? And what, like, just as a citizen, as someone who lives there, why are people, this scapegoat culture, this fear-mongering that goes on by politicians and by their acolytes, do you have a sense of where that's coming from in an era of relative prosperity? Like, what is going on exactly from your perspective?
Well, like you said, there's always that scapegoat culture that somebody's going to come in and do the work, do the jobs that other people supposedly, you know, they're taking away food out of other people's mouths. I think that's the bottom line, that people always fear that the next migrant caste that come in are going to be taking food or money, jobs away. And you know, East London in the last, you know, I've lived in East London for like 30 plus years, and you know, it becomes gentrified in that kind of concentric ring circle. Every area that you think won't become kind of, you know, have its coffee bars and its salons and cheese shops, you know, that kind of like Brooklyn effect, without being horrible to Brooklyn. Sorry, Brooklyn. You know, but that's happened in areas where, you know, I've lived and worked, where, you know, it is a poverty-stricken areas with some of the highest poverty in all of England. And all of a sudden you've got houses that cost £1 million next to estates where, you know, people can't pay their bills. And I think when you introduce things that cost a lot of money with things that are kind of like dirt cheap, and when you have like kind of housing for migrants which is cheap, and you flood an area, you just cause suspicion. Politicians stoke that suspicion for, you know, for votes. And everyone likes to live somewhere safe at the end of the day, and it's so easy to kind of like introduce elements of fear.
Yeah. Well,
it's not based on anything real.
No, it's all kind of fabricated and designed to question and suspect anything that's different than you, anything or anyone.
The other is kind of the
academic term that I grew up, like when I went to university 20 years ago, that was the big thing, the other, othering. And that is occurring. It is weird. Everything that I was taught anyway to anticipate is kind of coming to pass. Like, it's all very, you know, immoral and isolationist, and it is the opposite of punk. It is the actual opposite of everything I love about absorbing culture, like just being open to people and open to ideas. That seems to be the political stance that is on the rise, just being opposed to ideas, because new people coming into your life are going to fill you with new ideas. And there, for some reason, a cohort has emerged of people who say, we don't want new ideas, we want the old ideas. And they don't really mesh with a way that we can all live collectively. And I feel like those strains are on your record. I feel like there's a song called New Curfew, And I thought it seemed eerily prescient. Yeah, it seemed like there's kids wearing masks, and here we are, and then it's sort of like, I don't know when these songs were written in relation to the pandemic or this social unrest we're talking about, this political unrest and the fighting, but I assume most of this was written before the pandemic, yes?
Yeah, that song was written like last November or October, so there was no sign then of anything like the horror show we've got going on now happening. Unfortunately.
Do you use the word prescient? I didn't even have to. Do you feel like when you think back on some of these songs, do they feel eerie?
There's a few things on there where I'd have to think about it like a bit harder than I'm doing at the moment. But with New Curfew, it was to do with, I don't know, it's to do with gay pride, and it's to do with, like, you know, Black Lives Matter. It's to do with my daughter and her friends being a lot more switched on and politically engaged than we probably were as kids. And they talk about going, you know, and especially with, you know, the climate change protests as well. You know, my daughter and her friends are so kind of like aware of that stuff and aware of where the oppression and stamping down kids' ideas and nullifying them by saying, you know, they haven't got life experience yet. How do they know? We have facts and figures that they're not privy to. And, you know, it's shouting down in kids' faces. And I just thought that was so wrong. And I thought it's only going to be a matter of time before, you know, my daughter's out protesting quite righteously for things that she believes in, which will be for her future.
Yeah.
And at the same time, you see, like, the kind of, you know, the forces of police and control and government. And you think, how safe is your kid? But you wouldn't want them to not do it. So it's conflating, I don't know, the riots from East London a few years ago, some of the imagery that stuck in my head, my daughter going out to kind of make a point, and just as an older person, you'll understand that too. You know, you're meant to look for police and forces of law as being that, forces of law, and yet you see them as being like kind of quite murderous. Especially in those situations where they're tense, and you figure you're sending your kids out into like a murderous climate. That's that song, in essence. Well, and I think there was a nod to Dizzy Rascal in there as well.
Yeah. Sure, yeah. And there's also, like, I hear the tension between authority and I guess, I mean, there seems to be protest within the record. When I think of a song like County Pride, there's these lines, you wanted muscles, give me some manners, and I couldn't help but think of a protest scene. The kind of optics of muscle, of power and strength versus we just want civility and common sense and morality and to be treated fairly as people. There's some...
That's a good take. It wasn't... I'd never even thought of that. That line was meant to be kind of like... that line's meant to be a weird kind of seduction. As a means to escape. I kind of thought of two people that were not really meant to be together, but could have been their own escape nugget. You know, they could have kind of like got away from something which was a lot worse than either of them could do to each other.
Yeah. Doesn't that feel relevant? Doesn't that feel very contemporary to everything that's sort of emerged since you probably wrote these songs? Like, I'm just saying, are you a witch? Are you a wizard? Why did you know everything that was going to happen?
I don't know anything.
There is something to this. I know I'm joking around, but there's something to... I keep coming across this as things that were produced and made prior to the pandemic are coming out. It's probably psychological on my part. I'm reading into things, and maybe things that seem prescient were just happenstance. But I do think that artists like yourself, when you're thinking about things and you know, sensitively trying to write about them, you're tapped into something. You're tapped into something real that maybe leads to some foreshadowing, maybe leads to some anticipation of the way things are going to go. Again, you're way too modest to accept this as a compliment, I'm sure, but do you have a sense of that? Like, have you written things where you're like, whoa, okay, I was just expressing myself. I didn't think this was going to be the way all of society was going to behave. I was just expressing something that I had a feeling about. Do you feel tapped in that way?
I'm not good at relaxing very much. I don't relax, and I'm not somebody that can just go with the flow, or I watch too much news. I'm awake too much of the time. I'm a parent.
Yeah.
And I work for a charity. So you're just surrounded by things going wrong or on the verge of going wrong all the time, but you want it to be the other way. So it's, okay, so this is to answer your question. I always feel like in writing something or believing in it hard enough, you alter the course of what you think it might be at its worst.
Yeah.
I used to do that with people that I like fancied at school. Like if I thought or wrote about them enough, then they would like me.
Interesting.
Well, no, because sometimes it would work. You know, like that magical thinking. We have that line in one of the songs. I get accused by my partner that, you know, my magical thinking is, you know, like an erroneous thing. You know, it's ridiculous. But I always believe in magical thinking, whether it's making a band happen or whether it's kind of changing someone's mind or making somebody fancy you. I don't think it makes me a witch or a wizard, but I think there's a lot to be said about thinking something so hard and wishing for it that you make it real.
What is the bad brains thing? Positive mental attitude, right?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, that's probably what it is a little bit. Before we wrap up, we began in the early stages of this conversation in year one or two of this 3-year conversation. We talked about the Nation of Ulysses. You do have a song here called Stevie K. What is the relationship between Stevie K and the Nation of Ulysses?
Okay, so Stevie K is Steve Kroner, if you're looking at a direct link, who is guitarist in Nation of Ulysses. Mm-hmm. I hung out with him a couple of times when we were on tour, and he was just somebody that, you know, to me he was in this like most explosive band, and yet he was like the most humble, cool, genuine, gentle soul, and he could just like kind of walk away from stuff and never try and be in other bands or come back. So it's transposing that kind of being so cool that you don't care about being cool in anyone else's eyes, but also like that catcher in the rye thing, that anyone who thinks they're kind of like modern or hip, and if you use old tropes, that's not modern or hip. So like the kind of most modern or hip thing would be something that really hurt but would exist on the margins. That's in essence what Stevie K is. Somebody that's in pain, I guess.
Yeah, I can't tell if it's a tribute or not. It's sort of interesting.
It's every adult life song will be a tribute to something and a contradiction and a damnation at the same time.
That's what this
is. Not
interesting. Okay.
I think I could be wrong.
But no,
I think they.
No, you're right.
They all have a fault line where there's something transcendent, but there's something quite damning and quite badly wrong.
Yeah. At the end of this song, there's a spoken word sort of interlude. It seems like a phone recording or of a poem or something. How does that relate to the rest of the song?
Well, John asked me to do that. John wanted there to be something at the end which kind of signed the song off. And I just thought of that. It's kind of like he wanted it to be more of an FU to somebody, but I didn't really see the song as needing like something that was that harsh, but it was kind of like a lover's kiss off.
Mm. Okay. All right. Well, I appreciate the response to that and to this line of questioning. I know you don't do this very often. First of all, let me check in as we wrap up. Was this okay for you, Chris? I know you don't like talking very much. Are you okay?
No, this is, I am okay. Fine. Thank you.
I like to check in. I just like to make sure, because particularly for people who don't do these things very often, I appreciate it. So obviously,
I feel like I'm shouting sometimes. I hope I'm not shouting too much. I'm not used to having headphones on.
No, you're not. I'm sure it's fine. So we are in a period of suspension. You have a new record. You have a new band, relatively speaking. What do you do? What do you do in this moment where you can't play live? Obviously, you're doing press like this, but what else are you doing to further the cause and spread the word about adult life and this excellent new record?
Oh, what are we doing? I don't know, because we love the record. We love the record completely. So in a way, in a selfish way, it doesn't really matter what happens to it on a personal level. But because Kev at What's Your Rupture cares about it so much, and it's his record label and he's invested so much in it and in us, I want it to succeed for him. I think Sonny and Kevin would say the same. I know John thinks that. Like, we did it. and we love it and we don't want it to disappear, but we understand that there's probably more important things going on in the world than a punk rock record, however cool or happy we are with that record being made. Hopefully it will be one of those things that kind of doesn't come out in a big hype cloud and people discover it, maybe not overnight, but by word of mouth and by folklore and notes and letters and old-fashioned things. But it's step one. At the minute we can't play shows, but maybe in 3 or 4 months we will be able to, and then by that time we'll have more songs, and there isn't a time limit on adult life as such, so we don't have to panic too much about the fact that the world's in a mess at the minute. We can kind of take our time, see what happens with this record that we hope people get into. I really hope the people that like it and find it means something more to them than just another record. That would be the best thing.
I hope so too. I will say the more I've listened to it, the more meaningful it's gotten for me, and once we're done I'm gonna order I believe there's a limited run of vinyl, is that right?
Yeah, there's a white vinyl version with a white sleeve. I don't know what kind of limited it is, but it has the poster and the lyrics in it, and fanzine writer Jamie Johns done the little piece of writing which is on the back and on the front. Yeah, shout out to her.
Okay, I'm gonna order it once we're done here. If people want to learn more about Adult Life and this record, Book of Curses, where, I don't know if you know this, where would you send them on the internet?
Where would I send them? I mean, What's Your Rupture is the record label, and they have like the store where you can buy things from. But if anyone ever wants to write to us, we have an email address where people can write to us. I'd love it if people wrote to us. You know, like if people, you know, I would love to kind of collate the whole Adult Life family just from people that still like writing letters or making fanzines or sending well thought out emails. I'm sure if people just want to tell us to, you know, get lost and stop wasting our time, you know, if they want to do that too, it's all on you.
Very few people ask people to tell them off on the internet these days, so you're
well,
brave.
I'd love it. I'd love it if it was a well thought out telling off. If people really thought for some reason what we were saying was that bad, I would digest that and give it some thought. John's shaking his head and saying, "No, don't do that."
John has to manage the email address, I'm sure. That's probably why he's not happy about your suggestion there. What do you want to
okay,
give people?
I take it all back.
Do you want to give people that email address?
Of course. What's our email address? this is why we're in a band.
This is the one.
Just go onto the Bandcamp page and it's on there.
Okay.
Go onto Adult Life with a K, so ADULKT Life, and on the Bandcamp page it has contact details.
Okay.
And everything.
Okay. Awesome. Now, Chris, if we can go out on a song from this album to play for people, can you pick one for us? And if so, which one? Or rather, if so, why?
Oh, I didn't know you was going to ask us this. Can I ask John as well? I'll confer with John.
Yes, of course.
If Vish is going to play a song, and what song would we pick to play from the album?
From our album.
John said from our album. He wants you to play something by off the new Taylor Swift album, I think.
I was thinking Adult Life more than...
John wants us to play When Love Breaks Down by Prefab Sprout, which is...
No, I can't do it. I can't do that one. Is there anything else?
Junior Showtime, maybe?
No, not Junior Showtime.
You decide then.
New Curfew.
Okay.
Yeah, New Curfew, because you were talking about that one, and there's some backstory to it already.
Okay, we'll play that. And that's right. We already talked about it. All right, this is New Curfew by Adult Life from their amazing new record, Book of Curses. Chris, this was really, really a pleasure. I appreciate you indulging me in this, in these questions and in this time. I hope you enjoyed it, and best of luck with everything in the future.
Hey, Vish, thank you. Blessings. drones, listen out for the drones. Talk over everyone, pretending they got guns. Synchronize your watches, listen out for the drum, drum, drum. Dum, dum, dum. Drum, drum, drum. Snakes bite the hand that feeds down into paste. It's so hard when you're so close to snakes. Grab a gentle hand and crack it till it breaks. Dum dum dum. Dum dum dum. Dum dum dum. Dum dum. Cut off your laces, jump and then scream. Cut off your laces, jump and then scream. New curfew. It's a curfew. New curfew. What are these kids? 9 or 10? Masks wouldn't make them any less frightening. One day all this will just rot. She said, Dad, one day all this will be gone. One day all this will just rot. New curfew equals 9 or 10. New curfew equals 9 or 10. Lights wouldn't make it any less frightening. Masks wouldn't make it any less frightening. New curfew.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Very thrilled and thankful to Chris Rowley for being on this, the 578th episode of Creative Control, which is part of the Entertainment One podcast network and available wherever you get your podcasts, whether you use Apple or Google or Spotify or other things as well. It's on everything, really. But if you can't find an episode of the show that you've heard about and you're looking for it, or if you want to learn more about me and sign up for my monthly newsletter, I'd say I'm hoping it'll be monthly. I used to say regularly scheduled. What the hell does that even mean? You don't know the regular schedule. I don't even know the regular. There was no regular schedule. It was semi-regular. Then I used to say semi-regularly scheduled newsletter. Now it's aiming for monthly. We're going to go with monthly. Monthly newsletter. Anyway, if you need to do any of those things, find old episodes, learn more about me, sign up for the monthly newsletter, please visit my website, vishkana.com. You can also like Creative Control on Facebook, if it still exists, at the time that you're listening to this episode. You can also follow the show on Twitter at Vish Creative, or follow me directly at Vish Khanna. Twitter is probably still going to be around. Also, visit patreon.com/creativecontrol to make a flexible monthly donation to sustain this podcast. You have no idea. It's great. All the people who do this, who make a monthly flexible donation at patreon.com/creativecontrol. It's fantastic. Thank you for doing it. And again, if you donate $6 or more, you gain access to exclusive audio content. It's from my archive of interviews. Most recently, as I'm speaking to you, most recently, I posted a very fun and strange 2010 conversation I had with the filmmaker Harmony Korine, and that's up there. So if you, as I say, donate $6 or more, exclusive content, but whatever you can is fine by me. Again, patreon.com/creativecontrol. Thanks again to liveatmassyhall.com, where you can watch beautifully captured concerts by great Canadian artists. Also, Pizza Trocadero, The Bookshelf, and Planet Bean Coffee in Guelph, and Granddad's Donuts in Hamilton for their in-kind support for this show. My dear friend Jim Guthrie is a wonderful young man who's older than me, actually, but he's still young at heart. Anyway, Jim's great. You can learn more about him and his music at jimguthrie.org. And finally, thank you for listening to this episode with Chris Rowley of Adult Life, and hopefully you learned some things about Huggy Bear too. Both fantastic bands. The Adult Life album, Book of Curses, is really great. And it was fun. It was a nice thrill. And you don't know this, but Chris and I have now become kind of email pen pals. He emails me, and then I email him back, and then he emails me again. And that's just how email works. It's fun. It's a fun show to make. I like doing it. I hope you enjoy it, and we'll tell your friends to check it out and subscribe to it and all those sorts of things. And I will talk to you very soon. Bye for now.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.